Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. Do you enjoy science? I do. Well, this next product from ZBiotics is some super cool science. That happens to be something I did some research on back as an undergraduate. You may not know that alcohol breaks down into acetaldehyde in the body, which is far more toxic than alcohol, and it does a lot of bad things to your body until it gets metabolized by your liver. It is one of the components that contributes to you feeling terrible after drinking. So the more alcohol, the more acetaldehyde you have, and thus the more terrible you feel. I looked into ways to break down acetaldehyde faster, but I didn't really have access to the PhD labs, so I basically concluded my only option was to go on a big long run in the morning and try and burn it off. This totally does help, but it's rather stressful. However, Zach Abbott, the founder of ZBiotics, did do a PhD. He looked into the processes of the liver and how it breaks down acetaldehyde, and he genetically engineered a probiotic that does the same process. So if you want to live a healthier lifestyle, you can take the ZBiotics probiotic formula, and this will help your body deal with acetaldehyde after drinking alcohol. Note, it will not stop any of the direct effects of alcohol, such as being drunk, becoming dehydrated, or losing sleep. It only relates to acetaldehyde. However, that is a great thing for you and certainly contributes to feeling better the next day. So I would really recommend it. ZBiotics are a super cool biotech company backed by Y Combinator. They are working on lots of other cool stuff coming soon. For now, all you can order is their probiotic for acetaldehyde. You can get 10% off your first order using GROWTH10 at checkout. So go to zbiotics.com/growthmindset to find out. Again, that's zbiotics.com/growthmindset and enter GROWTH10 at checkout. Enjoy with caution. Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today we have Rachel Jane Cook with us, who runs lots of things, mainly amazing events, was why I invited you to the show, because you just have lots of interesting stuff about sort of millennial life crisis that you've been working on, and like trauma and therapy and mindsets and just all the sorts of things that I'm super fascinated in. And so I just kind of couldn't not have you on the podcast, basically.
Good to hear.
And I like to start the podcast with just a bit of an introduction to your life. So can you give me your life story in 3 minutes, please?
Okay, so I grew up in Dublin. Parents are still together, and I really happily together, which I actually think is largely to do with them sleeping in separate beds for most of my life. It helps a huge amount. I have one sibling, younger brother, and on all my report cards in school, it was always, Rachel is very gifted, talented, smart, but she doesn't apply herself. She distracts other people. So very early on, I took on this role as sort of a bit of a clown, entertainer. I was often just, enjoying. I was never malicious, but very much distracting people. And then went on to, I just loved things like English, art, was always very creative, and realized really early on, I mean, about maybe 8, 9, 10, that adults actually, which is quite strange when I look back on it, adults would come to me with things that they'd never told anyone. Now, sometimes they'd be drunk when they'd tell me. It might be like I'd be out in the pub with my dad as a kid. We'd often go to sports matches and things like that together. I had such an interest in people. And I found that from just even as a child, people wanted to talk to me about things that they didn't talk about to other people. So that was quite strange. But yeah, so I went on to do, my first degree was in the history of art and architecture with French. That was an arts degree in Dublin. And I had one job out of that arts degree and decided I was never going to work for anyone ever again. And I haven't. So I've now spent 13 years working for myself. And partly because it was a really bad experience. I was quite badly bullied by the manager that I had there, and decided after that I was going to make my life my own. So I've had lots of people over the years say to me, like, wow, this is incredible that you've worked for yourself for so long, that you've set up all of these businesses. And that's a lovely, flattering thing to say, but it feels slightly misplaced, I suppose, because I felt like I didn't have a choice. Not because, as in, I was forced to by my parents. You know, they were very, both my parents have been quite entrepreneurial. My dad ran his own business that he took over from his own father, but I wasn't pushed by them to be running something myself. It was more that I felt that I couldn't fit in well with a 9 to 5 or however long, 9 to 7, 9 to midnight lifestyle. It doesn't work for me. I'm not a morning person, never have been. And those might sound like quite simple things, but it just became extremely clear to me really early on that I was not going to go down that conventional route. Not out of wanting specifically to be alternative, but out of not feeling like that was going to be possible for me. So I started setting up my own businesses from then. I worked for a bit in sales and marketing. Then I did a short journalism kind of conversion course. So then I was working for different architectural publications that related to my history of art and architecture degree. So I was doing journalism in that. And then I decided that I was going to start training as a psychotherapist. And at the same time, I had a partner who worked for a company that also made vitamins, and he was reading Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek at the time. And so he decided to set up his own vitamin company. And I read the book myself, and I was selling some clothes and buying clothes on eBay at the time. And so we decided to start selling some of his products on eBay and Amazon. So for years and years, I ran those businesses, and that allowed me to pay for my psychotherapy training. It allowed me to travel the world for a couple of years. So I lived abroad. I lived in Spain, Germany, Jamaica, and then New York over the course of about 18 months. I did a couple of round the world trips. I traveled for the whole of 2015 as well, and I was seeing clients online at the time. So the whole trip paid for itself through seeing clients once a week. So yeah, that's kind of a definitely more than 3 minutes, but we've got a bit of a boil down of a little bit about how it started and where I am now with being a therapist and running different therapy platforms, different businesses relating to mental and physical health and speaking and educating.
Yeah. Wow. And on a radio show.
Yes. So I do a weekly slot on an Irish radio show, which is all about sex therapy. I get to tell people about pegging and anal sex and all sorts of stuff, which is really fun. It's great. And we've gotten a really good response, and we get lots of questions in. And it's nice to feel that it's really changing people's attitudes, because it's a big radio show and a lot of people are listening in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. So I guess from the start, you said you're a gifted child, but then often distracted. So, but clearly you're very intelligent. And so it's not like you're mainly meaning to be like annoying, just sort of different ways of using your intelligence, perhaps.
Totally. And I see this all the time in my practice. It's not that I necessarily think that I'm gifted. I think that maybe I was just bright academically as a child, but I was also social. I was creative. I was very extroverted. And so I was just quite bored by a lot of school, not because I was necessarily some genius, but just that people were moving at different stages, and just the way I think a lot of education is still, the way it's taught, is just it doesn't take into account the different learning styles of people. And I understand on some level why it's very, very difficult to include everybody and be able to create a system that will make room for everyone. But I still think we're making huge mistakes in our education system and how that's done. And so I see this all the time in my practice, that the way that people have adapted over time, it can be to do with gender, it's to do with their birth order in their family, to do with natural personality type and masses amount of societal, cultural stuff, that there's so many different ways that we start to adapt. And what I find interesting is that for some people that can come out as symptoms of ADHD, for some people even dyslexia, perfectionism, procrastination, being the comedian or the distractor, that these are not necessarily that I'm saying we're consciously taking on roles, but they are ways that we adapt. And now that I'm working very much through a nervous system and trauma-informed lens in the way that I'm a therapist, but it also informs how I am in life. I think there's a huge amount of crossover there in being able to understand the ways in which we adapt. And I think this form of therapy is very, very different to a pathological model, which is all about like what's wrong with you. This is much more about what happened to you and how did you learn how to survive. And that is a much more affirmative model of your behavior now makes sense based on what you experienced. Be that for some people, like it could be ADHD, dyslexia, not that I'm saying all ADHD and dyslexia is only down to trauma necessarily. It's more that they are potential adaptations that we make to be able to fit in a family. You know, for some people, it's becoming the the rebel. For some people, it's becoming like you often find in a family system, there's a scapegoat. So there's one child that the rest of the family are sort of like, they're the one that's the big problem. They're slow. They're far behind. They don't get anything right. They're always messing things up for everyone else. And it's often not on a conscious level. It's just fascinating how you see these family systems unfold and the different places that, you know, people can end up in, both in their family of origin, but then as time goes on, how that applies to them in later life, which I think is so applicable to business, work, careers, sex, romantic relationships, platonic relationships, a sense of purpose and meaning. All of these things, they really fit in, and I think they're very intersectional in that way, which is also sort of relates to how I practice as a therapist.
Yeah, lots of things clearly going on in your brain. Yeah, it is interesting when back to kind of just children, you think about like essentially as we kind of just trying to occupy ourselves, and you get like, if you get a bit bored, you kind of, you're searching for things that you can do. And when you just try like one behavior and you get like a bit of a reward and something like interests you, if you annoy the teacher a bit, like you just sort of train yourself to like want to do that, even though like the teacher's obviously trying to stop you. It actually gives you attention and makes you kind of feel like something's happening. And
totally.
And so you actually kind of get trained and like you kind of get the dopamine hit and you get addicted to actually doing the thing that you shouldn't be doing.
And negative attention is better than no attention, yeah, from a exactly. child's point of view. You know, for a child, what we are attempting at all times to do is to have our physical and emotional needs met in order to survive. And so someone being neglected or ignored or excluded, you know, that child, sometimes they will respond by going very internal. So they'll become quite involved in their own fantasy world, which is where I think for some people that might come out as being much more introverted in later life. But it also can lead to people having extremely rich imaginations and a lot of creativity. But that the downside of it is that that is an adaptation to having felt emotionally neglected or excluded, which again is often not on a conscious level. This is what I think is so important about understanding trauma, that it's not only the very overt stuff like abuse and neglect. It can be sometimes when there's, let's say, just a lot of children in one family, that some children are just, you know, it's like seeing baby birds in a nest. Some of them are going to be more energetic and have wider, more open mouths, so they're going to get more. And then others will get left behind, and it's almost like the runt of the litter. And so I think just seeing how that plays out for people is fascinating, and that you see that absolutely roles beginning to form when people are in school, when children are in school, and then how they interact with teachers, with peers, and then back to intersectionality. You know, when I talk about intersectionality, I'm talking about, it's a concept often used in critical theories to describe the ways in which oppressive systems are interconnected and that they can't really be examined separately from one another. So I'm talking about like racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, xenophobia, ableism, all of those things, classism too, of course. And all of these things are interconnected all the time for people. And so looking at that through the view of being a therapist and sort of an educator now is really exciting, because it's just exploded things in my mind as to being able to understand better how I grew up, how different things have impacted other people, and what it is that I want to do going forward in order to help people too.
Yeah, I can tell you want to discuss intersectionality, and I do too, but if we just backtrack
please
a little bit. So as in, you know how we sort of take on roles when we're in like a school or like family setting, I did always find that every time I changed school, it was always like a chance to sort of be different. And even if I go back and hang out with the same friends before, I sort of, I'm back at the same status, even though I'm like a completely different person, you just have this role assigned to you. And do you ever suggest that as an option to people, just try changing like their everything about it, like environment, to sort of try and, do you like coach them beforehand to try and be a different person?
I see what you're saying. And I would say there that this fits in really nicely with the trauma stuff, because if we're talking about coaching someone to be different, you have to have a baseline level of trust, safety, and stability in your own nervous system before you're going to be able to make behavioral changes consistently. And this is what I think is such a huge problem with a lot of motivational self-development material, in that it can be very shaming, upsetting, disappointing, and even pathologizing for people who feel that they're putting huge amounts of effort into trying to change themselves to be better at money, more confident, a better speaker. And often when your nervous system is not able to regulate itself, maybe because you've had a traumatic experience, or maybe simply that you weren't given the skills, the tools of self-regulation, and not just self-regulation, but how to co-regulate with other people. When we're not given those skills, you're dealing with an inflexible nervous system. For a lot of people, they're actually chronically dysregulated, meaning that that might show up as you're feeling very low, depressed, which you would call hypoarousal. So it's like under aroused, so low motivation, feeling quite numb, quite disconnected. Or then we can be in hyper arousal, which will be feelings of restlessness, irritability, maybe feeling like you panicky, you want to escape, anxious, obviously, openly fearful, these sorts of things. So often people are flipping between hyper arousal, so being too aroused from a nervous system point of view, or hypoarousal, meaning that they're under aroused. So, and both of those states mean that we're outside of our window of tolerance, which is kind of like what you would call optimal functioning. So when we're within our window of tolerance, which for some people is very, very small, simply because of the experiences that they've had and lack of tools that they have been given or have learned, it means that they're outside of it a lot of the time. And it's very, very difficult to learn and to change when you're not in your optimal window of tolerance, right? Because when you're over or under aroused from a nervous system point of view, your system is in survival mode. So it's not able to be like creative and take on new material or learning because it's focused on keeping you alive. And so that can be incredibly frustrating for people who'll come to me, who'll be like, look, I know that I'm capable of this. I know that I'm bright. I know that I have even possibly have lots of experience in this area. But anytime I try to get up on a stage, or anytime I try to talk to someone who I'm attracted to, I get flooded with panic, sweatiness, not being able to speak, going blank. It could be having physical tics, anything like that, which are signs of being outside of your window of tolerance. So your nervous system has now gone into defensive state to try and keep you alive. Actually, a lot of this trauma-informed therapy has been around for 30 plus years, but it's only really coming into common parlance and common knowledge in the last 5 years or so. And you're seeing it now with, there's quite a lot of trauma-informed schools in the UK and the US, which is great, and elsewhere. And trauma-informed practice is just becoming more and more common. You know, you see, like, I have friends who are trauma-informed yoga teachers and yoga therapists as well. And that this is just becoming more and more, hopefully in time, we won't even need to call things trauma-informed, because everything will just be inherently trauma-informed. We will understand that you have to look at things from a nervous system point of view, and from an attachment lens as well, which is maybe something we can talk about at some point today.
Yes.
So yeah, it sounds like, you know, it's incredibly well intentioned to be wanting to help people to move outside of their comfort zone. But if you go too far outside of your comfort zone, it just is experienced by your system as
your
traumatic.
Comfort zone.
Exactly. And it makes it harder the next time, because now your system has taken the message that those were signals of danger, cues of danger. Yeah, and so,
how, like, people develop phobias of going outside, kind of things. So they sort of go outside and get, like, abused once, and then, like, start getting more and more scared by people. And
Exactly. Yeah. And that it's not a conscious process. That's exactly the point I was making there, that, like, when you try to approach things only cognitively, that can work. You know, I see CBT, you see on the NHS, right? It's the, you know, the main form of therapy that's used in the NHS here. And CBT can really help people, for sure. I know lots of people who found it incredibly useful for very specific issues. The thing is that often people don't have just one issue, and it is a top-down approach, meaning that it only looks at things from a thinking point of view, rather than integrating a top-down approach with bottom-up. And I'm literally talking about the different parts of the brain. So top-down would be the higher parts of the brain, like the neocortex. Bottom-up approach means looking at the more primitive parts of the brain. So if we see the brain as a triune three-part, you've got the brainstem, which is the most ancient part, is the lizard brain or reptilian brain. And that's all about survival and reproduction. Then we go the bit around that, which is the limbic system or mammalian brain, and that's all about emotions. And so then around that is the most recent parts of the brain, which we share with some other mammals, but obviously humans appear to have by far the most developed neocortex. And that's much more to do with, you know, thinking, rationalization, logic, all of that. Now, it also has to do with imagination and memory for sure. Seeing the brain as this three-part model is really helpful for seeing that cognitive approaches. So things like CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, they are only really accessing the neocortex or thinking part of the brain, which is not going to be very helpful when the other parts of the brain are responding as if they're in constant emergency crisis survival mode.
Yeah, yeah. As in, like, when you think about humans as a core thing, and it's not, you're not that logical as you think you are. And when you're making any kind of purchase decisions, so if it's very emotional, it's like a root cause of like, I feel like I'll be more wanted and useful to the planet and people will like me if I buy this thing.
Exactly.
Rather than, oh, this is slightly better price thing. It's very emotional driven behavior.
Yeah, we like to think of ourselves as rational beings, but we are far, far more emotional than a lot of us would like to admit.
How did you make the transition from, okay, I don't want a job, how am I going to actually do something myself?
It was going to happen by hook or by crook for me. You know, I think I had been given the messages growing up. I was lucky to having had parents who were very conscientious. My mom is quite rebellious. My dad is quite risk averse, or, you know, low risk. But he was quite entrepreneurial, had set up his own things when he was quite young. And so I don't remember specifically having him push me in that direction. But I was exposed to him being quite creative in ways that he approached, I guess, work, and the same for my mom. And so I was very lucky in that that was something that was a possibility. I wasn't being filled with the pressure or messages of like, you need to get a good job. Now, I know that my parents wanted me to be a barrister or a brain surgeon were the two things they had decided for me, but they were fine with me also doing artistic things. I did a lot of art. I exhibited a bit when I was younger. I was doing quite a lot of acting. So that was nice to have that side of it as well. But the transition was having that one full-time job out of uni. And it was such a bad experience that I just said that was so painful. It was traumatic for me that I said, I'm never going to allow someone to have that control over me again. And I never have. And I think it's made me now, I would say, unemployable, which I'm pretty happy about. This was not a case of me having gone, no, I'm going to take this unconventional route and do it for myself. It was more something that felt like an absolute necessity. And so it felt actually quite easy and satisfying to start looking at part-time work that I could do, things that were, you know, affiliate systems. I mean, there was a couple of like pyramid, you know, selling of things involved there for very short periods of time before I copped on to what was going on.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, really being able to start with things like eBay and Amazon, that was really life-changing. It meant that I was earning great money to be working maximum 2 hours a day. And it was just a really convenient way to work. It allowed me for long periods of time to be able to travel as well. And so I would just be responding to the customer side of it, taking care of all the ads, updating things like that. But, you know, I was able to put like a little team in place, which made that very painless and gave me a taste as well for that very much like Tim Ferriss 4-hour work week idea of like, you do not have to be working like directly money for time.
Yeah,
which is interesting that I've gone from having done years of that to now in the past few years doing a lot more of direct money for time. But I think that has been a very conscious choice because I enjoy working with people so much. I just love being in front of people. I love working with people one-on-one. I love working with couples. I love working with teenagers, families. I don't do so much of, but a little bit. And then like educating groups, going in and doing talks to, sometimes it could be to 10 people. Sometimes it's to 200. And there's just such variety there in the skills that you have to use and how you connect with and impact people that I just find really thrilling and, you know, pushes that comfort zone, which, as I was saying to you before we started this today, recently has become a little bit problematic only because I had a few negative experiences where things went really wrong with talks, nothing to do with me, but to do with like the equipment, the tech, or just the umbrella company of how things were handled. And now my nervous system is telling me that speaking is dangerous. And so that's going to be something I have to work through for the next few weeks and months, where even though cognitively, intellectually, I massively enjoy, and emotionally, I massively enjoy giving talks and workshops, my nervous system on some level has been overwhelmed by a feeling that is dangerous. So I have to continue to work through that, which I do through my own therapy and daily practices. So yeah.
Cool. It's good to hear. I sort of quite relate to doing lots of my own things and feeling very unemployable. And I think the term incurable entrepreneur that was introduced to me last week and is something I kind of prefer a bit more because it sounds like you're not useless.
Yeah.
Rather than unemployable.
Also multi-potentialite. I quite enjoy that.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Multi-potentialite. Yes, definitely.
I didn't make that up. It's out there. But yeah.
Cool. But I have found that sort of not working with other people does kind of relate to the whole like not having community and sort of makes you more lonely, especially if you're living in London and stuff and like you don't have like regular people that you sort of always hanging out with, so you kind of you miss out on the social things as well, and you're suddenly like, oh well, both my best friends just left London, like I have no one to hang out with on the weekend. And you're like, well, I have lots of people that are kind of my friends, but like I don't sort of text them being needy. They're like, so Friday's coming up, can we do something, because it seems a bit odd.
And sometimes you might not even consciously feel lonely, right? This was something I found having also been in multiple, like back-to-back monogamous relationships from the age of like sort of 15, 16 until around 30, 31, with very little gaps in between, that when I was seeing somebody last year and then that relationship ended and it was particularly painful, but I really wanted to be single afterwards to really have a period where I was not dating anyone. Because even in the times where I wasn't in, let's say, an exclusive relationship, there was always people around, there was always people I was dating. And so this has been a really interesting eye-opening period for me, where even though, again, I consciously wanted to be single, from a more emotional and nervous system point of view, there were times where I felt I didn't even necessarily tune into the feeling as loneliness, because it's not that I was going, oh, I really want a partner or I really miss having people around me. It was a feeling of absolute disconnection, to the point where I was actually scared for myself at times, because I felt so disconnected from people that I was just like, is this where I'm losing my mind? Like, what is happening to me? Really, and that was partly because I had just never, I've been such an extrovert for my whole life, have lots of friends, do lots of things. I've always had people around me, you know, and I had little like boyfriends and partners even in primary school, where we would be just a lot of things like physical touch. I see this so much with skin hunger. You know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with promiscuity or people sleeping with whoever they want to sleep with. But I see so many people talk to me, or I have so many people talk to me about how the reason why they end up having sex or sleeping with other people is more to do with wanting to have a sense of co-regulation of their nervous systems. Maybe they don't use those words, but it's like cuddling, the release of oxytocin, the skin hunger that we naturally have, that is a biological need to connect, that when we don't have that, and it's also sadly still very gendered in that it's much more acceptable for people who've been brought up as women to touch each other, that we are more likely to hold hands or touch each other on the arm or maybe play with each other's hair. And that is still something that is seen as weak or is just very frowned upon for people who have been brought up as men. It's such a shame, because people are either accused of being gay, as if that's something bad to be, but that this can't just be something that we all enjoy touch. I think it also means that for heterosexual men, it becomes a real problem, because it means that they often are relying a huge amount on their female partners for their physical and emotional needs to be met. And that can create real problems, where men still often don't have anywhere near the same level of emotional connections with other people outside of their romantic partners, which puts a lot of pressure on the relationships, right?
Yeah, definitely interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really sort of looked at it from that angle, but it makes lots of sense. Thanks. Okay, so do you want to talk about intersectionality?
So intersectionality as a therapist, I think, is becoming so much more on the surface now, which I'm really pleased about. We're talking about like the vast array of impacting factors on any individual in their life or how they function in a relationship, you know, and how this applies to me as a psychotherapist is that, you know, access to psychotherapy is often a privilege tied to income, making it a really classist resource. So even organizations that can offer sliding scale fees are often really hamstrung by funding and also to limited, really short-term services. So you'll see a lot of charities, mental health charities, which offer people counseling and therapy. They still often will only be able to get 6 sessions or a maximum maybe of 10 sessions, which for many people is just barely scratching the surface. It is better than nothing for sure, but it can often leave people high and dry, where they've just started to get into a process and then the services are not there. And then you have like, I work mostly as a private practitioner and I offer scaled fees, but not that many private practitioners can afford to do that, because there's so many people who, you know, can't afford to pay almost anything. And obviously in private practice, you still have to make a living. So it just means that there's a lot of factors going on societally, culturally, economically, that make it really hard for people to get access. And then another thing around race, like the overwhelming majority of clients in my experience, less so in London, but overall, are even in a plausibly multicultural urban environment, there's nearly all clients are still very white. Mm. And that's not because people of color are not having issues. It's because they don't feel included, connected with, and they don't feel that they will be understood. I think there's a degree of implicit racial bias for a lot of white therapists as well. Another thing is that most of psychotherapy, although I would say overall there are more female therapists now, it seems, than those who identify as men, most of psychology and psychotherapy has been developed by old middle-class white men who absolutely cannot speak to the lived experience of women or people of color or any other diversity or minority. And so creates a lot of questions around, you know, how applicable a lot of therapy is to people who are not white, male, middle class, and lots of other things. So, yeah, there are a couple of things. So, you know, or even just something simple like not that many therapist offices are disabled accessible. You know, mine happens to be, it has a lift, but I know I've worked in offices before where they're not accessible by wheelchairs. And so it's just another problem that is often not thought about and not talked about in any real terms. You know, I have therapists often saying things like, I don't see color when they're talking about, like, they're trying to say that they're not racist. And it's like, look, all of us on some level are implicitly racist, homophobic, transphobic. For someone to deny that we have implicit biases is incredibly naive and can border on being willfully ignorant, and it's very dangerous. You know, I think we can all do our absolute best to, and I hope that we do our absolute best to be questioning our biases, but that to imply that any of us has completely gotten rid of them is pretty wild and very naive. So yeah, I just think that's another area that I'm looking forward to seeing more written about. I mean, lots of people are writing about it. It's just not really come into the wider societal view yet. Mm. And we're on the cusp of that, which is really exciting, of dismantling, you know, systems basically of oppression and preferential treatment and institutions that have been serving certain people and seriously leaving out a lot of others.
Pretty huge. Yeah, I've been reading a lot of like feminism stuff as well, and the amount of like data and things that have been built around white men is ridiculous.
Yeah. You know, I see this in diagnoses a lot, where it's, I don't know if you've heard of these terms, but like borderline personality disorder, which is the diagnosis is inordinately given to women. And then we have narcissistic personality disorder, which a lot more men are diagnosed with that than women. And I think they are not necessarily that they are similar, although I do think that any of these labels, they are simply clusters of symptoms, of behavioral symptoms, right? Anything, whether you see that as a label like ADHD or a label like depression, these are all clusters of symptoms. And they can be useful for sure in helping people understand what's going on for them and possibly then being able to access treatment and care. But they can also be incredibly stigmatizing and limiting because, you know, they are pathologizing. It's like having a diagnosis of depression that can become someone's identity, which can be destructive for them to be seeing themselves through the lens of depression rather than this is a cluster of symptoms. This is a set of symptoms that has come from somewhere, you know, and that's the intersectionality comes in there. You have a combination of how someone was brought up, their natural personality type, their race, their ethnicity, geography, where they were born, you know, class, all sorts of stuff that's going on. So my point about like borderline personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder is like how interesting it is that one of them is so much more assigned to women and one to men, or, you know, far more men are diagnosed with alcohol dependence and far more, I think it's women still at the moment are diagnosed with depression. We have 4 times more men who take their own lives than women. Now, people who identify as women make more attempts on their life, but men kill themselves 4 times more than women do.
Wow.
That's a massive epidemic. We're looking at like roughly, I think the stats at the moment are that roughly around 1 million people a year now take their own lives. That is huge.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Now that's around the world, but yeah, it's like, it's still a lot. And it's not like it's disproportionately small in the UK. So yeah, back to diagnosing. I think that something like borderline personality disorder, which is also known as emotional instability, and sometimes it's called that, or emotional regulation disorder, that that has been, you know, that if it's all old middle class white men who, you know, you'll have read some of the works out there, if that has a lot of it been very much like emotionally repressed, then it can be quite a convenient diagnosis to just see women as being hysterical and too emotional, too sensitive. That is white men deciding what level of emotion one should have.
Do you think that would mean that you'd give a different treatment to someone who was given like borderline personality disorder, but it was like on a low ranking and perhaps shouldn't have been ranked as that? But then what would you suggest as like the thing that they should go and do then?
Well, I would look at it from a really intersectional lens. Let's look at all the things that are going on. What is the trauma that you've had in your life? What culture did you grow up in? Who were your caregivers? You know, what other things have impacted you growing up that have led to this? That this, you know, I think viewing things as a case of like the brain just going wrong. Now, I do believe that sometimes we can have a guess. I don't even know if I do believe that we can just have a chemical imbalance in our brain. In my experience, that always comes from somewhere. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a chemical imbalance, it's that that has
I mean, if you've got like a tumor or something, like perhaps, but otherwise it's usually your environment that's affected you.
And for me even with something like a tumor, you know, I have seen this. Now I'm not going to say that I can cure cancer as a psychotherapist, however, definitely not going to say that, but I have seen so many times that people, especially with, it could be autoimmune disorders, that once they have regulated their nervous system, this is not some woo-woo stuff, this is not me saying it's about being magic as a therapist or a, you know, health practitioner or a healer or whatever someone would call themselves. It's more that when you are able to allow the system, the nervous system, to relax, to release tension, to allow the system to stop being so stuck in a defensive state, you know, be that fight, flight or freeze, which are the three main defensive responses that the nervous system has, that when we are able to relax out of chronically being stuck in those states, you go into a form of homeostasis and the body is able to heal itself. The body cannot heal well when it is stuck in emergency or crisis mode. And so when we are able to take a person out of being stuck in that dysregulated state, which might be that they're feeling angry all the time, it might be that they're very depressed, it might be that they're extremely anxious. When you can help people learn how to relax their state, their nervous system, people begin to heal, because the body is always trying to keep us alive. So of course it wants to be in a better state. It doesn't want us to be ill, because if you're ill, you're going to be picked off, or you're not one of the healthy ones of the pack, sort of thing. So even with something like a tumor, I see this, you very rarely will find someone who has a tumor where, now you could say this is everyone experiences stress, right? But it's for each individual, how you have all those different intersecting factors that will have impacted them, you know, and that someone like a person of color is going to have experienced racism in a way that a white person simply will have not. And so even if they feel cognitively okay about, you know, they might feel angry, feel upset about it, but overall are just like, okay, that's really shit, but right, that's what's happened. Their nervous system has still experienced that as a real threat to safety. And so some people are experiencing a lot more threats to safety. Obviously, someone who's living, for instance, in an active war zone is going to be experiencing a lot more threats to their safety on a nervous system level. And so that is happening for us all the time with, again, things like social media and the news. I've had people who are extremely anxious about the coronavirus recently and just really overwhelmed by, on one level, knowing it's basically the flu, you're almost certainly going to be fine. And another level feels absolutely terrified. You know, on a really primal level, it feels terrifying. Like its idea and how we, you know, how we often rehearse anxiety as well.
Yeah.
Thinking of what it will look like when it's a, you know, sort of Walking Dead scenario.
Definitely. Those things haven't helped at all, really.
No.
And then the news doesn't help the way it's sort of, it's always kind of like weird, scary virus pictures and people in masks and stuff. But like loads of people die from the flu every year as well, which is the thing that's not really been focused on.
No, and like, look at this outpouring about the coronavirus when a million people are taking their own life every year.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, yes, there are lots of people doing good work around suicide and charities out there and organizations for sure, but it's not anywhere near in the common cultural awareness that it needs to be.
Same, and like, well, we spend twice as much money on anti-terrorism as we do on climate change. And you're like, terrorists. Like, it's just bonkers. Good. Anyway, any other solutions first and how people can kind of become better besides just sort of cultivating better relationships and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't think everybody has to go to therapy, right? But it is incredibly helpful, insightful, and growthful to do the work with someone. And I've done this with friends many times, and you know, sometimes none of them are therapists, where we'll have like peer groups, support groups as such. And you know, having peer groups is an amazing thing to do. You know, it also ties in with community care, this idea of how self-care is all about the onus on the individual, and how that ties in then with the idea of community care and how we've lost a lot of that, especially living in big cities where it's impossible to just pop into someone for a cup of tea without organizing it, you know, a month in advance. And then you have to travel like an hour across London to do it. So you're completely exhausted and didn't even really enjoy it by the time. So community care, this idea of being much more involved. And there's like levels of emotional labor with this. A friend of mine was running a trauma-informed yoga teacher training over last weekend. And it was something very simple, but I made a little commitment to myself to just check in on her over the weekend and to celebrate what she'd done. And it was so lovely because we got to speak on Sunday night when she was finished, and she was like, it went amazingly. I just felt so in flow, and I'm just so, so happy with how it went. And I just felt like I was in exactly the right space. And it was lovely for me. I got a real dopamine endorphin hit out of hearing her talk about doing her magic and having a great time. I'm getting like goose pimples now, even having, you know, talking about it. And she was so grateful. She said to me, she was so incredibly grateful that I had sent her a couple of messages over the weekend and then had called her for us to be able to celebrate that together and enjoy that. You know, that helps the bond between us. It helps the sense of trust. It feels like she's my tribe. She's my people. And that was a really simple thing that any of us can do. Like, yes, there's emotional labor involved in that. Like, sometimes I might forget, or sometimes if I know I'm particularly busy or tired, I might have to put a reminder in my phone, you know, or in my calendar to say, call so-and-so or message so-and-so. And, you know, that once you build that into your lifestyle, it feels a lot easier. You know, also calling people on the phone instead of messages. That one sounds obvious to some.
Yeah, but it's, we're just so disconnected from doing that these days. It just doesn't seem natural. And well, half the time people don't pick up either, which is
And then we feel awkward, right? And that's why I think having conversations, this is like back to the emotional honesty, having conversations, it doesn't have to be that you're saying to someone like, you have to speak to me every week. It's about saying, look, you know, maybe you might say, oh, I've called you a few times recently. Is it a bit inconvenient for me to call? Usually someone will say, no, not at all. I was just busy right when you called. But in future, is it okay if I give you a ring back when I'm free? You know, and sometimes that will work. Sometimes you'll end up doing phone tennis. So then you might just decide, we're going to speak at 3 p.m. on Tuesday. But that it feels like an ongoing process that you have openly with people. And asking people for what they need and want in relationships as well, that I think we so rarely do that. We go to our friends and our therapists, or, you know, maybe even family members, to talk about our relationships with other people, rather than being more honest about what it is that we feel and that we want with the person in question. And I think a therapy is often very helpful in being able to do that. Start bringing the issues that you have to the therapist and work on those with the practitioner. But then in time, you know, it allows you to be able to feel more confident in how you speak about those things without being blaming or shaming with the person in question. So that, to me, is a big one. And that applies to everything to do with your own success, you know, having peer groups, support groups, mentorship, all of that, as you know, I'm sure you've talked about a million times before. But, you know, we go over and over this stuff because it is what works.
Yeah. Thank you. And then finally, onto psychedelics as an extreme form of things, and actually perhaps shouldn't be seen as quite so extreme.
No, definitely shouldn't be seen as so extreme. So I did a few psychedelics recreationally in my sort of late teens and early 20s. Now, over the years, I'd maybe taken drugs recreationally a few times for sure, but I hadn't taken any psychedelics. I'd basically had a decade hiatus. And so 3 years ago, I decided to start taking them recreationally in the sense that it wasn't in a clinical setting. But the purpose was very much as something to use for self-development, insight, to have beautiful, creative, imaginative experiences. And I found it incredibly profound, you know, doing psychedelics sometimes on my own, which is a very different experience to doing them like I would organize weekends away with friends and we'd go and take, it could be LSD or magic mushrooms together. And that is just an amazingly connecting, beautiful experience and very, very regulating. You know, what I find is that with especially psychedelics, it's nigh on impossible to become addicted to them. It's more what happens is you feel very, very calm, much more interested in the smaller, simpler, deep details of life. I've spent hours just staring at a leaf or a snail while high on mushrooms and just being able to then apply a little bit more of that, a little bit more wonder, awe, imagination in daily life outside of being high, which really increases connection with other people, but also trust within self that I feel I just don't get bored. And so I do a lot of psychedelic integration with clients. So I don't TripSit because that is still illegal for any sort of medical or health practitioners to do in the UK with people. But people will go and have their own psychedelic experiences and they'll come to me afterwards for us to integrate what they learned from that, what they experienced. Sometimes people will have frightening experiences or they might have had flashbacks or memories or visions of things that they really don't understand or led them to feel uncomfortable, scared, angry. And so we sift through that together to find what is meaningful, significant, useful to them that they can find rewarding. And gosh, I would recommend it to almost anyone.
Yeah, I found it myself just being super useful to kind of step out of like normal ways of thinking and just see things from a completely different perspective and be like, actually, I really don't need to be like worried about these things or like working on this stuff. And super helped me find myself in many ways. And I guess it would just be nice to sort of know just most recently how you've transitioned into marketing yourself and sort of running events and getting onto a radio show, like these kind of things. Like how do you go from being someone that runs like a vitamin business online to like becoming an outspoken person with many views?
Yeah. So I think a lot of that has happened really organically. And that's where I think putting yourself in positions where you meet people is so helpful. You know, for a while I was going to lots of networking events and finding them really just like not necessarily boring, but that I wasn't maybe connecting with people in the way I had hoped. So I felt a bit deflated, disappointed. But then I started, you know, it's like how I'm here today with you. You were, you know, had planned on coming to one of my talks that you saw through Funzing, you know, and that was a platform that I was speaking through. And that developed because I can't even remember now if Funzing reached out to me because I was already talking for other platforms. But, you know, I think it always starts with these smaller steps. You can have this bigger goal. And my big goal wasn't necessarily to be doing talks to 200 people, but I did imagine myself in time like running retreats, running workshops. And now I'm having to kind of update those goals again because I've done all those. Now, it's not that they feel like I've done. And so I never want to, you know, host a retreat or give workshops again. But back to the comfort zone, you need to feel like you're still challenging yourself, which obviously you can continue to do through certain platforms. But you have to feel, it's important to feel like you are pushing and challenging your comfort zone to a level that still feels like gratifying and feasible and creative without leading you into overwhelm. So most of that has come about from talking to people, you know, and I think now, yeah, therapy and mental health has so much, there's still a stigma there for sure, but so much less of a stigma that a lot of my clients are very happy to refer me to other people that they know. Sometimes they might ask me to give talks or workshops at their workplace. So asking for referrals, which I'm careful about, you know, in regards to therapy, because I don't ever want people to feel pressured of by trying to get me more business, but often people will offer. And it means that whenever I give talks, you know, I will always have other things on the go. Like at the end of a talk, I'll be saying, These are some online courses that I've got going on at the moment if you want to join. These are some groups that I'm part of. These are some more talks that I'm going to be giving. So having some sort of lineup and funnel, I guess, for people, suddenly you start to see this explosion of like exponential amounts of opportunities, where once it felt like, oh God, like I'm out here on my own. How do I get anything going on here? Nothing is happening for me. It's like just keep tipping along with making connections with people, and don't be afraid to ask them for recommendations and referrals. And that has been, you know, over the last 10 to 15 years, absolutely where nearly all of my new business opportunities have come from, is from other people.
Cool. And then is that how you got the radio show then?
Well, that's a funny one. So a friend of mine voted me at school in the yearbook most likely to be a sex therapist, which was quite funny. I was giving lots of sex advice to people as a teenager and getting in quite a lot of detention for it at school. And she voted me most likely to be a sex therapist. And she is now a radio producer. And so she was producing this show and she said, Rach, we have to make the dream happen. Let's realize it. And so she asked me to come on the radio show. And it started off just as a one-time thing. And then we very quickly developed it into right away, because we got such a great response.
It became
a weekly slot. So I do that every week now for the last nearly 8 months, which is incredible that it's been going so long. And I think out of that, I've had people approach me asking me to give quotes for magazines, for TV shows. Some of them I've taken them up on it. Some of them I haven't for various reasons. And yeah, I think that's, again, having little opportunities that start to feed into other things. People see you, they maybe like your vibe or something that you've said. And I think social media, like Instagram for me, not so much personally, but for me, finding other therapists and people to connect to around the women's circle, the social justice groups that I run, I've just found such amazing people on Instagram in the last 6 months. And I think it's just a phenomenal resource of people doing amazing and really varied things. And it's so easy to send people a message. You know, I've felt slightly starstruck at times when people who I think are putting out just, you know, such fantastic content, that I have messaged them to say, I love what you're doing. And every single time I've had positive responses from people. So that's been really rewarding as well. But yeah, these past connections, right?
Yeah.
It's like going back to having the network of people. And that when you are putting other people, not necessarily, I'm not saying to put everyone before yourself, you've got to put your own oxygen mask on first, right? But that we view things instead of through a competitive level of, oh God, they've got something that I want, or, you know, I can't give too much of my material away because, you know, then what will people even come to me for if I give all my good stuff away? It's like that mindset, that scarcity base that keeps you small, constricted, tight, and self-involved. When you are able to reach out and help other people, they are naturally going to feel safe and regulated with you, which is going to make them more likely to want to help you in turn. And so that is something where creating these networks for yourself that can build up. Sometimes it takes a few months or even years to build certain networks, but that anyone can reach out and go to like a meetup or go to a talk, go to a workshop, reach out to people, ask them about what they do. You know, I can't even fully remember the quote now, but it's something like, in order to be the most interesting, to be viewed as the most interesting person, be the most interested. Be interested in what other people are doing. Tie it back into what you're doing. See if there's any opportunities there for how you might collaborate or help each other out. But that once you reach out to people, I find they're just so much more likely to want to do that for you in return.
Definitely. Cool. On which, is there anything I could collaborate with you on?
I would love to collaborate with you on something. I know you mentioned that you're doing a couple of other podcasts, and I really love this sort of platform. Now that, like, I wouldn't have done a podcast this time a year ago, I wouldn't have come here today because I wouldn't have had the experience of feeling that I had spoken in a way that was being recorded. Now, I had already done quite a lot of talks, workshops. I'd hosted a retreat, but it's funny how our nervous systems
or that seems like way scarier.
Yeah,
like
you know, right? And these are like, not that it is, but that these are like different levels in different ways to people. And, you know, first of all, like with the radio show, the fact that it was live, I was bricking it. I was like, what if I just completely lose my train of thought? So I started by, as we were talking about today, you know, I trained myself to read notes but sound like I was not reading them. And that was a skill in itself. But then through doing that, I was able to actually feel much more confident about just speaking off the cuff. And so then with the radio show, like, I needed less to send in questions beforehand for the host to ask me. I was, you know, I felt confident enough that she could ask me absolutely anything, and that, you know, okay, I can't answer every single question, but that basically I would feel okay in myself to be able to, you know, make some sort of attempt at an answer that made coherent sense and was helpful to people. So from that, I now feel much more confident doing something like this. And I also really enjoy, because with the radio show is based in Dublin and I'm in London most of the time. So I've noticed how much I miss having the face-to-face element. So, you know, even though this feels a little bit like the radio show, because I know it's going to be listened to, the fact that we're able to see each other and are sitting, you know, close to each other adds just a much more enjoyable element for me.
Cool. Stuff to look forward to. And then just finally, what's the kindest thing someone's done for you?
The kindest thing. So something I've noticed is that when, and I think this is common for a lot of people, but I'll speak for myself right now. When I'm in a really good state, you know, sort of emotionally, mentally, what I'm attracted to in other people, not necessarily just sexually or romantically, but in general, what I'm attracted to is people being very curious, creative, sparky, even intellectual, that sort of thing. And when I'm in a rough state, when I'm feeling disconnected, down, not good to myself, what I'm really attracted to is people who are consistent and who are kind. And they have become my tribe. And I have an amazing group of friends and people around me who are very, very good at checking in that community care kind of way. I just feel so grateful to so many people around me, friends and family included, and even past partners. And that has been, for the most part, really fulfilling relationships where people will reach out and I know that I can say absolutely anything to them.
Cool. Well, lots of good advice. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Yeah.
Look forward to the next one.
Soon, yeah. Cool.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learnt by contacting us through the website growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.